beer, I like to drink of it. The more I know New York, the more I think of it. I like the sight and the sound and even the stink of it. I happen to like New York. I like to go to Battery Park and watch those liners booming in. I often ask myself, why should it be? They should come so far from across the sea.
Manhattan Murder Mystery is the 22nd film written and directed by Woody Allen, first released in 1993. Woody Allen and Diane Keaton stars as Larry and Carol Lipton, a couple that live in a New York apartment building across from an elderly couple. One night, one of the elderly neighbors die from a heart attack. Nothing seems strange, but Carol begins to suspect something, and she can't let it go, despite the doubt from her friends and husband. After a period of drama, both on and off screen, Allen returns to something that is brightly comedic with Manhattan Murder Mystery. It's a much-needed breath of fresh air compared to his previous film, Husbands and Wives. And in a crowd-pleasing move, it reunited Allen with Diane Keaton. Welcome to the Woody Allen Pages podcast. This week, we look at 1993's Manhattan Murder Mystery. How it was conceived, how it was made, and how it was a bit of a laugh. Spoilers are everywhere, so watch the film and then come back.
This would be a really great way to kill somebody.
There are a few directors whose very name is a genre. Woody Allen is almost there. If you hear that someone has made a Woody Allen film, you can kind of imagine what it will be. But one that is certain is Alfred Hitchcock. The legendary director of films like Psycho and Vertigo had the nickname of the Master of Suspense. He basically created the language of suspense in cinema. Even Allen, the biggest European cinephile, has expressed his admiration of American Hitchcock over the years. Allen likes trying on genres, and Hitchcock was one that he always wanted to try on. As Allen made more dramas in the second half of his long career, you can see more and more Hitchcock in the way that he builds suspense. It's in later films like Match Point, Irrational Man, and the recent Coup de Chance. But in 1992, he finally decided to make his version of a Hitchcock film, and the origin of that idea goes all the way back to the 70s. After the extremely heavy Husbands and Wives, Allen wanted to make something explicitly light. In the background, he was fighting a custody battle with Mia Farrow, so after making possibly the heaviest film of his career, it was time to muck about. Allen looked for a fun idea that didn't have to deal with God or the depths of human relationships. He also probably wanted something that was simple. No costumes, no custom sets, no historical research. The film he ended up making also had a relatively small cast, one of his smallest in the 90s. That story was an old murder plot that he had set aside decades earlier. Allen's murder mystery plot goes all the way back to the mid-70s at least, and at a time when Allen was working on the follow-up to his 1973 film Sleeper. Allen was developing a script set in modern New York and was collaborating with a friend and fellow writer, Marshall Brickman. But Allen would ultimately abandon that script to make Love and Death instead. Allen returned to the murder mystery script after that, which would go through several more changes. And with Marshall Brickman's help, it would ultimately become Annie Hall. A lot of changes happened to that film along the way, including cutting out that whole murder mystery plot. Some scenes of the murder plot were apparently filmed during the production of what would be Annie Hall, but no one has ever seen them. But we know some of how it would have gone. In those early scenes in Annie Hall, when Alvy and Annie go see the sorrow and the pity, it was followed with them coming home and finding one of their neighbours had committed suicide. In fact, the character who died was a professor, like the one who died in Crimes and Misdemeanors. But that professor was an optimist, so Alvy and Annie believed that he would never commit suicide. It's that small feeling that something doesn't add up that sets off their investigation. But Allen abandoned that plot, and Annie and Alvy broke up, and the professor ended up in Crimes and Misdemeanors. Allen hung onto the idea of the couple coming home to find a neighbour had died for decades. Possibly, he held onto that idea because it came from a kernel of real life. Allen in the 70s had come home to his apartment to find that one of his neighbours had died. But the dead woman's husband seemed fine, probably just holding it together well compared to Allen's own manic neurosis. Either way, the image of the stoic man whose wife had just died stuck with Allen. It's a scene that Allen recreates in Manhattan Murder Mystery.
Oh, hello. Hi, Mr. Hasson.
Thank you for
sorry.
A wonderful flower.
Oh.
That's quite that's, nice of you.
Is there
sure,
anything we
no,
can do?
Anything, anything, you need, anything at all. I mean, God, it's just... such a shock, wasn't it? I mean, it was just so sudden. I mean, she seemed so, God, well, healthy.
Yeah,
I mean,
she had a heart condition.
She did? Mm. She never mentioned it. Well, she was...
She wouldn't have.
No. Right. Well...
If there's anything we can do.
Yeah, you know, anything,
if you need
really.
Anything, if you're lonely, come by, you know, whatever you like.
You owe me a wonderful French dessert.
Oh, no, no, no. I know. I haven't forgotten. Believe me.
Well, have a nice time. You saw the old Gussie there?
Oh, I know. We're going to the opera.
Oh. Enjoy.
Yeah.
Good night. Good
night.
For a few years after Annie Hall, Allen would try and revive that murder mystery. At one point, he gave the whole plot back over to Marshall Brickman to write and direct, with Allen promising to star in what he wrote. That didn't happen either, and ultimately, in the early 90s, Allen got around to it. He invited Marshall Brickman back to collaborate, and the pair, not having worked together since Manhattan 14 years earlier, got to work. They worked like they did in the 70s, going for long walks in Central Park and having dinners, pitching ideas to each other, and then Allen would write it all down later at home. Instead of Annie and Alvy, what Allen and Brickman gives us is Carol and Larry. Even though Allen wrote this script initially for some version of Alvy and Annie, like a couple, nothing stopped him and Brickman from changing it to be a one-person story or a different kind of duo, so it's interesting he kept the couple at the heart of the film. There's plenty of precedence for couples being detectives. Probably the most famous was Nick and Nora Charles, the fast-talking couple from the Thin Man films of the 1930s, or there's Audrey Hepburn and Cary Grant in the very funny thriller Charade. Allen has seen them all and is clearly paying tribute to them. But Carol and Larry aren't Nick and Nora. It's maybe older Annie and Alvy, but really, it's Woody Allen's screen persona and Diane Keaton's screen persona. Allen almost makes no effort to hide it. Keaton's Carol is the wonderfully big-hearted oddball who loves everyone. Allen's Larry is the ball of anxiety and suspicion who loves Bob Hope. So when, early in the film, they are invited over to their neighbours for a drink, Larry is reluctant and awkward. Carol is open and curious. We know these characters, not from this film, but from the culture at large. It's a bit of a shortcut, but getting to know Larry and Carol deeply isn't really the point. They don't really have backstories. Any backstory we really need is to know that they are the cartoonish New Yorkers you know from Allen's other films. There's a reason this film isn't just called Murder Mystery. Manhattan is a big part of it.
I mean, I don't understand why you're not more fascinated with this. I mean, we could be living next door to a murderer, Larry.
Well, New York is a melting pot. I'm used to it.
Throughout the film, Larry and Carol live this romantic and probably fantastical New York lifestyle. They live in that magnificent doorman apartment building. They go to Madison Square Garden to see sport, or they go to the Met for the opera. They see old films at the cinema in the middle of the day. They go to flea markets in the middle of the city and theatre at night. This couldn't be, say, Milwaukee murder mystery.
To dinner.
All so the way out to New Jersey.
So, hey, kid, this is the apple. This is a town that never sleeps. That's why we don't live in Duluth. That plus, I don't know where Duluth is.
But they do have a journey to go on, and it's mainly driven by Carol, arguably the lead of the film. Carol is looking for something in her life. She's been thinking about opening a restaurant. She's worried about getting old. She wants a little more excitement. Because she's looking around for more, she also reads too much into things. She's the one who thinks that Mr. House is underreacting and that something is amiss.
No. I mean, Mr. House. Mr. House. Didn't he seem a little too cheerful to you?
Mr. House, our next door widower?
Yes. I mean, he seemed too composed for a man whose wife just died, don't you think?
Well, Jesus, what do you want the guy to do? Walk down the street sobbing hysterically?
Well, I don't know. All I know is they were supposedly looking forward to their, you know, anniversary. And you know, if I suddenly dropped dead, wouldn't you sob for months or years
Don't make those kind of jokes, okay? I don't like those remarks. And meanwhile, I'm the guy who needs a physical checkup.
Well, I don't know. I mean, to me, he just seemed a little too perky.
For the first half of the film, Allen keeps us guessing. Despite the title of the film, Allen leaves room for us to doubt that there was a murder at all. Maybe Carol is overreacting. That's certainly what Larry tells her. Her suspicions come from small, apparent clues. There's an urn with ashes in the kitchen when they said that she was going to be buried. Mr. House leaving in the middle of the night. Mr. House not being upset enough. For most people, this wouldn't even be noticeable. Larry, being the reasonable one at first, says it's nothing. The clues that could be nothing is the stuff of classic mysteries. As an audience, we are wondering, how does that urn fit in? We collect the clues along with Carol, and we expect everything to be explained. Carol's suspicions turn to action when she decides to sneak into Mrs. House's home. Suddenly, she's gone too far. She steals keys. She breaks and enters. It's also one of the most tense scenes in the film, coming early on. It's not just that she sneaks into the apartment, she makes a phone call while she's there. She could have made the phone call later in her home, but she puts herself in danger. You want to scream at her through the screen. It's great edge of your seat filmmaking.
I'm gonna look around and see what else I can dig up here, okay? Yeah, I'm telling you, this is just it. I'm just dizzy with freedom. This is the craziest thing I've ever done.
Yes, it's crazy. But soon we'll be too old to do anything crazy. Go, leave.
After that, Carol continues to overstep. She talks too loudly in the theater. She almost gets run over explaining the bus incident to Ted. She encourages Larry to rush into the hotel. She's putting herself at risk. The main if of the film, in the first half at least, is Larry. We are watching to find out what happens and who killed who, but we are also watching to see if Larry will come around and support Carol. It wouldn't be much of a film, but Larry's suggestion that they don't pry and not get involved seems reasonable. Most people would not be sneaking into their neighbor's apartments. Throughout the early part of the film, Larry is doubting everything. Larry's doubting and cynicism allows Alan to give himself some really good lines.
Happening?
No, wait a minute. No, he was with this young model type and they were talking about money.
Well, so what?
That's the motive.
What? Hey, listen to me. Come here.
What are you talking about?
Come here. Wait a minute.
Come here.
Look, I've been
Larry?
Thinking about you.
What do you mean?
You got to see you. You got to go back to your shrink. I want you to see Dr. Ballard again.
Larry, I went for 2 years.
Yeah, I know, but you know how General Motors will recall defective cars? You got to go in for a tune-up.
We'll be in and out in 5 minutes.
No.
So we go from supporting Carol because what she's doing looks cool and fun to supporting Larry because Carol is in danger and we want the two to agree. The stakes of the film is really this silly old couple's happiness. And in a way, Alan cheats by casting Diane Keaton, because we've been hardwired to want Woody and Diane to get together in the end. Any threat on that would pull our heartstrings. Alan continues the point with Alan Alda's Ted, who is set up as a romantic rival. Ted is an interesting romantic rival. He's taller and more handsome than Larry. He's not Mr. Charming. The main reason he's a romantic rival for Carol is that he's lonely and he needs her. He's affectionate, emotionally available, and open. Larry isn't those things. He's closed off. Alan illustrates the point by the two very different ways they wait in cars with Carol. With Ted, the conversation and the ideas flow. With Larry, they are silent and Larry just wants to go home.
So you bored?
Well, it's more fun than the Vatna opera.
Yeah, well, to me, it's just one of the most exciting adventures I've ever been on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Would you rather be here with Ted?
Well, he has a more enthused attitude, Larry.
More enthused?
Yeah, enthused.
Well, he's a fun guy. He's a light guy. I'm a heavy guy. You know, Ted would be fun on a scavenger hunt.
Larry, you used to be a lot of
fun. He's the guy you want if you really have a heavy scavenger hunt. He's the man.
I know, but, you know...
Alan gives Larry his own temptation as well, in the shape of Angelica Houston's Marcia Fox. She is a sort of romantic rival for Carol. Fox seems to come from another film. She's less a character, more a mysterious force that floats in and out of the film. She's so distinctive in her black dress, indoor glasses, and mannerisms. Alan has taken real larger-than-life characters and adapted them on screen before, like Mia Farrow's character in Broadway Danny Rose. This feels like it must be one of those cases, although I don't know who it is. She could be some sort of Anna Wintour figure. Character-wise, though, she's a hell of a lot of fun. She's the smartest person in our Scooby-Doo gang, and the only one who is set up to be smarter than the audience. And even though she talks the least, we all want to hear from her. There's the scene at the restaurant where Marcia plays Poirot. She has worked out the plot. She knows how to trap the killer. And then, she goes to the bathroom. Any other film would have just kept the scene rolling. Why take a bathroom break? Alan takes a break for a number of reasons. One is so our lead characters can react to Marcia. Carol in particular is jealous. Marcia is the competent true crime expert that Carol cannot be. But two, it also lets the audience know that, let's take a break here and just think about how awesome Marcia is. It's very Woody Allen to interrupt the exciting plot development with a character bit.
Where did you find her?
She's really something. She's got one idea after another. It's like one thing leads to another.
I'm surprised you two didn't drill yourselves to death.
We just had a nice first date. Yeah.
I knew that they would hit it off.
Yeah,
I knew this.
Yeah, huh? What about you? You were going to jump into her lap. I saw you, Larry.
What are you talking about? Come on.
What
What's wrong with you? I'm her editor. I'm a little father figure to her.
Yeah, the only thing you didn't do was rub your hands together. That was it.
What, you gotta be joking. Are you telling me that you're jealous of Marsha?
Well, it's not that I'm jealous.
Kids, people.
Thank you.
People, what are we doing here?
Yeah, and look who's talking. My God, I mean, you kept staring into her eyes like she was the dragon lady.
What's wrong with you? You're jealous because he's interested in her?
You're just in her.
The older couple, the killer and his apparent victim, Paul and Lillian House, get no inner life either. In fact, apart from run-of-the-mill greed, there's no real motive for the crimes. In a way, their ordinariness is the point. You don't suspect it. This isn't Match Point. This isn't an intense study into why someone would be driven to murder. The murderer isn't the story. The rest of the Scooby Gang are also in the basket of just enough for the film that we need. Cy and Marilyn are the friends. No backstory, they are just there. It's a nice touch that by the time Larry's on board, so are all the friends. It feels like there's no doubt at that point that there is something going on. It feels great to have the whole gang there. And in the end, Carol is vindicated because it's not only Larry on board, but so is everyone, including us as the audience.
Wait, so what you're saying is... Wait, no, okay, what you're saying... Oh, boy. You're saying you want to provoke Mr. House into trying to murder Larry and me.
Yeah, it's perfect. You're not scared, are you?
No, I'm not scared. I'm not scared. I'm turning it over in my mind. I just want to check with my clergyman before we commit.
Larry believing in Carol is what kicks off the second half of the film. He sees the still alive Mrs. House and we're off. People talking in rooms is fine for your average Woody Allen film, but this one is a mystery and the rules of film tell us that it all has to lead somewhere. Things have to build and there has to be a face-off. Allen writes several tense scenes that build and build. There's scenes in Mighty Aphrodite or Midnight in Paris where someone is trying to do something and not get caught and it's played for laughs. Here, it's played for tension. Comedic tension and homicidal tension turn out to be similar. There's the wonderful scene with the tape recorders. Our gang's plan isn't bad. It's a bit technical and it relies on people being incredibly skilled. But of course, every good plan in a film goes wrong. Convention states that once a plan is laid out, it has to get derailed. And as the one-sided conversation stalls and the tapes get stuck, it's tense. But it's also funny. Alan is at the back of the group, clunking around, hilariously ripping into the tape.
Hold on.
We don't have an answer for that. What do we do?
Go to a different thought.
Mm-hmm. What thought? What?
Shh. You either got to pay them off or get rid of them.
Look, we can't talk about this on the phone. Can you meet me?
Yes. They're keeping it refrigerated.
What? What'd you say?
About 2 hours ago.
What? 2 hours what?
Hold on.
Jesus, we're all screwed up. I got this all screwed up.
Okay, let's get off as quick as possible.
All right, we'll
We've done it.
Do something.
Shh. Okay.
There's a much smaller tense scene that I love. There's a moment when we are first in Mr. House's cinema. He's being spied on by Carol and Ted, and he seems to hear a noise. But it turns out to be his assistant. It's a misdirect, but it's also a way to quietly introduce an important character without the audience noticing. It's very clever.
It has such a lonely feeling.
That's because I'm the only one here, and my assistant, Mrs. Dalton. I'm going to have this place fixed up, then I'm going to sell it. The money's going to come in handy.
Sure will.
What's that noise?
Well,
oh, Mrs. Dalton, I didn't know you were here so early.
Oh, I didn't know whether anyone was here. I'm sorry. I heard the noise, and I thought...
It's quite all right.
I apologize.
Quite all right.
It all leads to the big showdown. But the big showdown actually happens before the big showdown. There is a scene just before Carol is kidnapped, and the pace changes where she and Larry have a fight. They fight about Ted and Marsha, and everything that's been building up is aired. Again, Alan lets us know what the film is really about, and it's Larry and Carol's relationship. Capturing the murderer means nothing if they lose each other.
What do you mean? I just don't understand how you could give a book to Marsha and not to me.
What are you
just talking
about? We just had a big success in there. Marsha likes to read what I like to read.
Oh, right, God, yeah. Well, it's true. I guess it's true. I mean, we got nothing in common, that's for sure. Now that Nick's grown up, I mean, you know, we're just left facing each other.
You got stuff in common with Ted, right? You can cook together with Ted, or you can take your clothes off and baste the chicken with him.
Oh, well, what about you and Marsha, huh? What does she teach you besides poker? That's what I'd
Mud
like to
wrestling.
Know.
Okay. Is that what you want to hear? Look, nothing. I'm her editor.
I think the time has come for us to reevaluate our lives.
I reevaluated our lives. I got a 10, you got a 6.
The film's final showdown, the shootout in the cinema, is all about Larry saving Carol. Whether Mr. House dies or lives or gets caught, it's kind of incidental and it doesn't matter to Larry.
You don't know what's going on out there. I will never say that life doesn't imitate art again.
We gotta call the police.
Yes, and a glazier.
Quick, dial.
The plot is tied up with very classic murder mystery tropes. It's the jilted lover and Mrs. Dalton, the assistant who lied for him, who kills Paul. The age-old motive of promises were made. She just happens to have a gun, and she just happens to come out on top in a gunfight. All the pieces fall neatly into place. It's not a film of messy morals. We don't see any consequences, and we don't really learn anything.
I'm aiming at you, lover.
Of course, killing you is killing myself.
The
same thing.
But you know, I'm pretty tired of both of us.
There's a suggestion that Ted and Marcia get together in the end. Or at least, it's the start of something. It doesn't feel earned. The two don't seem to share anything. But it's a nice end for them. I think by the end of the film, we just want to see the people that we like being happy.
I want to celebrate or something. What do you want to do? You want to go see what Larry and Carol are up to?
I think they want to be alone.
Oh, yeah. Okay, all right. Will you have any plans?
You're taking me to dinner, right?
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Which is exactly how the film actually ends. It's just with a scene of Larry and Carol walking on the street and chatting. Or is it Alan and Keaton? Because it just seems to be improvised, the two of them joking around. It's the payoff we've been waiting the whole film to see.
Where do you want to go for dinner tonight? Let's not eat at any restaurant where they serve cowards. You're laughing
at me. You know, Larry,
at.
I love you.
I love you.
How could you ever have been jealous of Marcia? Isn't that ridiculous? Don't you know that I could only love you?
You were jealous of Ted.
Ted, you gotta be kidding. Take away his elevator shoes and his fake suntan and his cap teeth, and what do you have?
You.
Right? I like that.
If Alan's aim was to play around with classic murder mystery tropes, he does a good job of it. In fact, he often does a good job of it. Alan has claimed that he comes up with good plot twists or scenarios for cinematic crimes all the time. Like the mechanics of how to kill someone and get away with it, which came before he wrote films like Match Point or Irrational Man. Also the crimes in Small Time Crooks or The Curse of the Jade Scorpion, where the films weren't as strong, but Alan worked hard to make sure the plotting made some sort of sense. And when you think about it, the body count in Woody Allen's films is actually quite high. It sounds like, morbidly, for this, Alan just reached into his pile of good ways to stage a murder. He picked the idea of a visiting dying sister and using the body as a very public body double as a cover-up. Yes, it's one of those murders that could only happen in cinema. In films like Love and Death or Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex, Alan directly made fun of the genre that he was parodying. Here, Alan makes references but doesn't really poke fun. If anything, he's enjoying the convention. But the plot itself is genuinely fun. The huge reveal of Mrs. House being alive is a gut punch. The way the story keeps you guessing is done well. This isn't a comedy version of a mystery, there's genuine tense mystery afoot. Throughout the film, the characters discuss some silly murder ideas. Marcia writes mysteries. There's also explicit references to Double Indemnity, the 1994 film noir classic directed by Billy Wilder, and The Lady from Shanghai, the 1947 Orson Welles take on film noir, and of course, Hitchcock. It's a very meta part of the script that the characters are very fluent in the language of murder mysteries. But not only do the characters know the murder conventions, so do we. And Alan knows that too.
I know. What about this? What if they had a big insurance policy or something like that?
Too much Double Indemnity, you know?
Alan would later say about this film that it wasn't really about anything, that it lacks any big point or meaning. Alan in the late 80s and early 90s had been focused on drama. The 5 years before this, he made films with points, such as Husbands and Wives, Crimes and Misdemeanors, and Another Woman. Manhattan Murder Mystery was supposed to be a laugh, a bit of a plot and adventure over meaning. The final title was just a working title too, but like Snakes on a Plane, it just works. So why change it? Larry at one point refers to a book called Murder in Manhattan. That could well have been a title as well. But I will argue that Alan can't help himself but make some sort of point. He makes the film about a couple and the bit of work that you need to do when you love someone, and you have to support them or believe them or you lose them. There is also the pointlessness of deaths, the brutality of how ordinary it all is, and the irony that maybe Mrs. Dalton would have killed Mr. House if Larry and Carol did nothing. It's Alan's cruel fate philosophy just peeking through again. So this is not just a Hitchcock cover. It's Woody Allen making Hitchcock his own. That mix is what makes this film special. It's not just pastiche, and that clash of flavours makes for an interesting taste. The overwhelming taste is still fun and funny. There's plenty of good lines. It's probably Allen's funniest film in half a decade. There's real excitement and moments of hooray. And it helps that the production was wild enough to keep the script interesting and moving.
Larry, is this the most exciting thing that's ever happened to us in our whole marriage?
This is too exciting. I don't need this. You know, I like something, I like a fishing trip or Father's Day, you know, or the time we saw Bing Crosby walking on Fifth Avenue. You know, I don't need a murder to enliven my life at all.
You know, whoever...
As the title clearly alludes to, Manhattan Murder Mystery is set in Manhattan. And Manhattan really looks great in this film. Of the 15 films Allen made between 1986 and 2000, only two were not set in contemporary times, and only one, September, was not set in Manhattan. Allen really loves New York, I don't know if you know. There's a couple of conspicuous helicopter shots of the city, and that's not something that Allen has done before. Allen rarely goes to the expense of that kind of shot. He does so here, shooting the city at night when it looks gorgeous. It's the opening shot of the film, and another shot is used later. Don't worry, Allen wasn't in the helicopter at the time.
It's perfect. You're not scared, are you?
No. I'm not scared. I'm turning it over in my mind. I just want to check with my clergyman before we commit.
There's plenty of other excellent New Yorkiness on show. There's Madison Square Garden, the Lincoln Center, the 21 Club, and the legendary Chelsea Hotel. Allen's favorite restaurant, Elaine's, appears in one of Allen's films once again. It's yet another fun tour of the city. Beyond the landmarks is that wonderful upmarket doorman apartment block that our characters live in. It's so New York. It's on the Upper West Side on 78th Street. And what makes this story, the close living of an apartment building, is the way this story works. If you like watching TV and film to see gorgeous, unaffordable New York apartments, then this is for you. But I like that it's not the elegant family home in, say, Everyone Says I Love You, nor is it the mess of Harry Block's home in Deconstructing Harry. Carol and Larry's home feels properly lived in, but nice. There's lots of cool posters, especially that huge Canal Street sign, and books everywhere. If I had to guess, I would say that this is probably close to how Woody Allen actually lives, aesthetically.
Can you believe this guy in Indiana killed 12 victims, dismembered them, and ate them?
Really? Yeah, it's an alternative lifestyle.
Yeah, I'll say.
Returning a cinematographer is Carlo De Palma, who had been working regularly with Allen since 1986's Hannah and Her Sisters. With Allen and regular editor Susan E. Morse, the trio has broken all traditional rules with husbands and wives. Manhattan Murder Mystery is much more traditional, but still manages to carry some of the swagger of that previous film. Throughout the film, there is camera work that defies popular convention. Take the long shot. It's something Allen has always preferred. Other directors who love long shots have ones that can last up to 30 seconds. Allen's scenes can last 3 or 4 or even 5 minutes. It gives actors a chance to shine with no cuts. But with Carlo De Palma, the long shots became a dance. De Palma used handheld cameras that swing around the scene as much as the actors. It leads to a very kinetic camera style. One of the most obvious long takes is the shot of Larry and Carol as they go all around the Bryant Park fountain. They aren't always in shot. The camera isn't always level. I can't imagine they took too long lighting the scene. It's very much guerrilla filmmaking. Another great long shot is the scene where Carol comes home after seeing Mrs. House. The argument she has with Larry is a long take over 3 minutes. The camera constantly darts around. Sometimes you can't see anyone at all. Sometimes the person talking is out of focus. But it would be a boring scene otherwise. Allen's films are usually really talky, and De Palma's camera work really helps to keep the film interesting.
Oh, Jesus, you're not on about Mrs. House again. I thought we'd have a light dinner, you know, because we had a rich lunch at 21, I thought.
Larry.
What?
I just saw Mrs. House.
What are you talking about, the ashes?
No, a bus. It passed me and she was on it.
The dead woman passed on the bus? Really? Which bus was this, the bus to heaven?
No, but I'm not joking.
The other great thing about these long takes is you're able to see the little moments between Allen and Keaton. Watch the person not talking and you can often see a wry smile or a little giggle. Either one seems to want to break character at any given time, probably because they are just having fun in front of the camera again. There's even a moment when Larry and Carol are in bed that the screen goes dark and they continue talking. It's hard to tell, but it seems to just cut to black, like a digital black, not the scene with the lights out. Why not? What are the rules? There's other little production tricks that just help jolt this film along. There are sudden harsh cuts where the music and the soundtrack stops and we're somewhere else. In fact, the sound design of the film has so many interesting, sometimes showy, moments. There's another long take, filmed at Elaine's, where characters talk over each other and dialogue overlaps. Or when Larry and Carol finally talk to the cops, they are frantically talking over each other.
And then you see what happened was I suspected Mr. House, right? He runs a movie house.
And then suddenly she's on the side of the bed, and she was laying on the face, and the girl was nervous, I tried to keep her calm, but I couldn't.
There's what?
What do you mean there's nobody up there?
There's nobody there.
How can there not be anybody up there? We just saw her there. She was laying on the floor.
She was totally dead. She's there.
But it's not all wild cutting and handheld shots either. I especially love the shot at the end of the Helen Moss auditions, when the camera pulls back at the end of the sequence, when Helen's back is towards us. It looks like a staged dolly shot, and yes, it feels Hitchcockian. Overall, the film is a nice mix of the punk rock wildness of Husbands and Wives and Allen's more traditional work. There's a jagged beauty to this film, and Allen with De Palma are just at the top of their game, full of ideas. Of course, a good murder mystery needs to have tension. Allen does tension well, and would later do it even better in films like Match Point. But here, Allen and his team craft some wonderful sequences. It's interesting where Allen spends his time. That sequence with Helen Moss, where they record her and make the tape, is actually quite long with very little dialogue. That Allen stays on it shows that this is the fun of this film. It's watching the tapes and the plan come together. It's also tense, just having to wait as someone splices tape together. When the tape is done, it's almost a moment of cheer. Watching the plans unfold and the little wins along the way is one of the joys of the film. There's also the closest that Allen has ever gotten to a car chase. There's genuine energy in those scenes as we are led to a factory and learn another part of the mystery. They encounter a big fiery pit and there's lights and fire everywhere. At another point, Larry wrestles Paul whilst holding a gun. It features the least convincing gunshot sound effect I've ever heard, but it's another scene that almost feels like action. It seems pretty safe overall, but I imagine Allen had to hire stunt safety people, which is a rarity for him.
What is this?
I could never bluff.
What?
I've lost a fortune in cards over the years. I'm not a bluffer.
Get up.
The other great sequence is the final shootout in the cinema, with all the mirrors. It is a tribute to Orson Welles' film, The Lady from Shanghai. That film is actually playing in the cinema during the final shootout. Bruce Lee also took that ending for Enter the Dragon, and film buffs will say that there were people who did it before Welles, but it's clearly Allen's take on Welles that is happening here. He's doing his own version of that mirror scene and making no effort to hide the inspiration. The scene on screen almost literally mirrors what is happening in the film. It looks amazing, a shootout with mirrors whilst another shootout is happening in the background. Considering it's on a Woody Allen budget, it's a great cinematic finale.
Help!
They can't see us behind the screen. And they can't hear us with the sound on. Not even a gunshot.
I know it.
The production of this film was caught in the breakup of Woody Allen and Mia Farrow. There's been a lot said about what the film was supposed to be. Allen was working on this film with Mia Farrow in mind. For the last 10 years, he had been working with Mia Farrow in mind. Nothing strange about that. But then they broke up and Farrow accused Allen of terrible things. The common story is that Mia Farrow was all set to play a role in this film and that she actually turned up on set on the first day. This is after she accused Allen of sexually abusing their daughter. She's still expected to be in the film. We won't rehash too much of that nonsense, but what is also crazy is that Allen maintains he only made one change when Diane Keaton replaced Mia Farrow. But it was a major change. He swapped the roles of the characters. Initially, it would have been Woody's character who was suspicious and driving the story. I guess similar to how he does it in Mighty Aphrodite. Mia Farrow's character would have been the cynical one. It's a very astute understanding of casting and audience by Allen. If you have Diane Keaton, she's the one you need to put in danger so the audience reacts. She's the one you care about. According to Keaton, it took her a little time to return to the rhythm of a Woody Allen film. but what we see in the finished film is oozing with chemistry. Keaton also shines in several scenes that doesn't feature Alan. She's great just by being nosy on her own. She's the bigger lead character and has no problem holding the film. Women of her age aren't usually cast as leads, but when Keaton gets the chance, she shines. And Alan obviously understands her energy implicitly.
I'm right!
So you're right, so big deal! But this kind of right is going to put us in the toilet, so you're right. You're suspicious. Yeah, right. It says more about your mind than
about
him.
What about your rigidity? How about
get
that?
Get into bed, get into bed.
Point?
You're so, what's wrong with what? You?
Alan Alda returns to the Woody Allen fold. The second of three films he would make with Alan. He was great in Crimes and Misdemeanors and great later in Everyone Says I Love You. And he's great here. His persona is interesting as a rival to Alan's energy. He's just a cooler, more open, more positive person. That positive energy was well used in the horrors of war in many seasons of MASH. Here, he brings in a childish enthusiasm to the film that we need. Without him, everyone would either be scared or doubtful. When he says he likes Marsha Fox, we like Marsha Fox. When he says a plan is brilliant, we think it's brilliant. It's a smiling Alan Alda talking to you. How can you not be charmed?
I figured out how he killed her and made it look like a coronary. He gagged her and tied her to the treadmill, and then he turned the exercise program up to Olympic levels.
Also returning from Crimes and Misdemeanors is Angelica Houston. She played against type in Crimes and Misdemeanors. Here, she plays larger than life, in a way more common with her famous roles, such as The Addams Family or Witches or others. She chews up the screen and has been given a great character. If this was made in the era of streaming, there'd be a Marsha Fox director streaming spin-off. Angelica Houston had some scenes cut, and that could have been because Alan put his character in the backseat after casting Keaton. There was a scene where Larry tries to awkwardly kiss Marsha that was apparently so genuinely awkward it's not in the film.
It's great, that's, you know, you have all these skills, and you're beautiful, and you can write so well, and now it turns out you play poker. This is too
well,
good
I wouldn't
to be
say
true.
Beautiful.
Oh, I would.
But I do have tremendous sex appeal.
Okay. You sold me.
But let's not forget Woody. He's fantastically funny in a way that we haven't seen him in years. You'd probably have to go back to Broadway Danny Rose almost a decade earlier to see him be so funny. He doesn't have to carry the film, so he can just be on the side and throw one-liners. There's a scene where he talks to himself because he's not needed. That's kind of how he gets to be in this film, and he's great at it.
Her?
So that's where he hit her!
Oh, Jesus, claustrophobia and a dead body. This is the neurotic's jackpot.
Of course, none of this film works unless Jerry Adler, who plays Paul, wasn't his usual brilliant self. This was actually one of his first screen roles, having spent decades in theatre as a director. He just holds an unshakable gravitas. If Alan was initially inspired by a neighbour who seems unshaken by the death of his wife, you couldn't get more unshaken than Jerry Adler. He would later be great in The Sopranos and The West Wing, always playing men of great silent confidence.
Now look at these presidentials. Look at the color work. Even the perforations are still in there.
Where's Carol? I should really be going, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Coffee's ready.
Oh,
coffee. I forgot coffee.
Good. We can get back to this later. Come on in.
This was also the first significant screen role for his screen wife, Lynn Cohen. She also came from Broadway, and this would launch her into many more memorable roles. She's very funny in the comedy They Came Together, and would work with Alan again in Deconstructing Harry. Both Adler and Cohen were indicative of the way that Alan works with New York-based talent. If he worked in LA, he'd be hitting the same pool of actors as everyone else. In New York, he gets Broadway talent that are fresh for the screen. This also goes for many of the minor roles. Take Ada Turturro, who would later come to fame in The Sopranos. There's a pre-The Wire Wendell Pierce as a cop in a non-speaking role. Ron Rifkin, who at this point was best known for his theatre work, would later find fame in Alias. Joy Behar, a New York comedian who had worked with Lorne Michaels and Larry David, would later go on to be the host of The View. Zach Braff has a single scene as Larry and Carol's son. I'm guessing he had scenes cut because he set up and never paid off. But as his scene was the introduction of Marsha Fox, he's still here. Braff, for his part, said he was extremely nervous. He was a big fan. He would later go on to much bigger fame in the show Scrubs, and then later work for Alan in the musical Bullets Over Broadway.
I loved it. I love chocolate.
I know.
If only he could stay in town. If only he could stay in town just a couple of hours.
I was going to, but
what about
they're
that?
Working us so hard at school, I can't. I gotta get right back.
Really?
The opening credits song is I Happen to Like New York. The song is by Woody Allen favourite Cole Porter and performed by Allen favourite Bobby Short. Short and Allen were both regular performers at Cafe Carlyle in New York for many decades. Short also appears in Hannah and Her Sisters. It's an interesting choice of song, as it has nothing to do with murder or mystery. Again, it's that first word in the title, Manhattan, that is the true love of Allen's. And it shows once again that all he really wanted to do was show off this city he loves so much. The rest of the music is pretty standard Woody Allen stuff. He uses Errol Garner tunes like he has done in a dozen other films. He would reuse Dave Brubeck's Take 5 in Mighty Aphrodite. He reuses Sing 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 from New York Stories, and he'd reuse it for Deconstructing Harry. But if the choices were a bit uninspired, the use of music is pretty good. The music used in the scene where Carol is sneaking around in her neighborhood apartment is The Big Noise from Winnetka, a tense instrumental performed by the Bob Crosby Orchestra. But then the second half of it, when Mr. House returns, the film is silent. Allen uses his song choices as score and uses it really well. And you walk away from the film with a spring in your step.
And when I have to give the world my last farewell and the undertaker starts to ring my funeral bell, I don't want to go to heaven, don't want to go to hell. I happen to like New York. I happen to love New York.
Manhattan Murder Mystery was released in 1993 through TriStar Pictures, the second and last film they would work with Allen on. Some of the leaders at TriStar had worked with Allen before, since the United Artists days, and he had followed them when they left for Orion and now TriStar. Allen's previous TriStar film, Husbands and Wives, was a modest hit, and so was this. It was no doubt driven by the casting of Diane Keaton, but the film got generally good reviews as well. As Allen was going through his much publicized battles with Mia Farrow, there wasn't any promo circuit with Allen and Keaton together. Imagine the two of them in 1993 appearing on press junkets together. As it was, there was almost no interviews for the film. It kind of helped the box office. The film didn't really harm the award circuit either.
Remind me tomorrow to buy up all the Wagner records I can, rent a chainsaw.
Allen said that this film didn't really have a bigger meaning. But the thing is, I love that. He probably personally doesn't care for that opinion, but I don't need every Woody Allen film to be heavy and weighty. It can be so great when he simply wants to entertain. I love seeing Woody Allen's take on other genres. It's a film literate approach that isn't for everyone, but there is joy to see what Allen does with it. Yes, it's a humble work with a small cast. There's no amazing sets or large elaborate set pieces. Yes, it's kind of one note, but I kind of like that note. And this is where Allen's film a year habit comes into play. It kind of affords him that freedom to make something that isn't a tentpole every time. In fact, it's a welcome break. And if you want a bit of comfort food cinema, how can you go past seeing Woody and Diane on screen? Plus semi-regulars like Alan Alda and Angelica Houston. It all seems like so much fun. For me, Allen cemented and mastered the thoughtful New York comedy in the 90s. It's an incredible run of films. He would later make some not as good comedies, and then go to Europe and then make dramas. I love a lot of those films, but this is the start of the last great run of Woody Allen comedies. And after all these years, it's still a joy.
Do you think that's going to happen to us?
What?
Well, that we'll become like them, you know, just another dull aging couple, you know, with our little walks.
You're a dull aging
couple.
Our
TV, our locks and bagels, and our twin cemetery plots.
No, we should be as lucky as them to, you know, to be in their physical shape at their age. They look great. You see the dumbbells this guy lifts?
Yeah.
If I lifted dumbbells like that, I would get a hernia the size of the San Andreas Fault.
Here's some fun facts about Manhattan Murder Mystery. Allen would not work officially with Marshall Brickman again, although they remain friends. When they wrote together, they went for long walks in Central Park, and apparently those walks continue, even without a script. It was Brickman's success with the musical Jersey Boys that inspired the Bullets Over Broadway musical. Melanie Norris is a bit of a mystery in this mystery. She plays Helen Moss in her acting debut, and does so confidently and quite well. But she only has two other acting roles after this, both very minor roles. I wonder what happened to her. That's another mystery. And finally, will Woody Allen and Diane Keaton ever work together again? For both Allen and Keaton, they are probably always being asked about it. Even now, for me, as a Woody Allen fan and a Diane Keaton fan, I would love to see them in one more film. Why not? There are several reasons that Alan and Keaton have said over the years about why they don't work together. Schedules. Keaton works on less projects than Alan, and you really have to be available at the right time to get that Alan role. But they also don't want to ruin what came before. But we know the two remain very close friends. Alan even presented Keaton with a Lifetime Achievement Award from the AFI in 2017, one of Alan's rare public appearances in the last decade. Maybe one day, they will be back on screen together.
Okay, are you happy? Now can we go back to bed? No. For crying out loud, it's no big deal. You're making a mystery where nothing exists.
Okay, I got it. Wait.
Thanks for sticking with us. It's nice to be back. The Woody Allen Pages podcast is back to finish season 3 with 6 episodes. 5 films, including this one, plus a special episode. There's a few ways to support the podcast. There's still a Patreon, and I don't blame you if you've dropped off with the big gap, but I'm thrilled about those who have stuck with me. There's also the Buy Me a Coffee tipping service. Or buy my books. The Woody Allen Pages Film Guides, the most comprehensive breakdowns of most of Woody Allen's films. He's gone and made more since I put this out. There's also a bit of merch that you can buy with the podcast artwork. All the links you need are in the description, along with links to all the social media and the website and ways to contact me. Okay, next week, possibly Woody Allen's most personal film ever.
I can't follow his car.
But he's right up ahead. He's right
there.
Where
up ahead? I don't know which car I'm following here. I'm not a good driver. I can't chase somebody in a car. I'm going to have an accident. I'll wind up hitting a school bus or something.
Look, it's nighttime. There's no school buses at nighttime.
Don't tell me that. What about night school?